This episode is supported by ZavoLife. And let me tell you, I've actually been using this every day. I just mix a teaspoon into my morning smoothie, and it gives me this clean, steady energy that doesn't feel like a crash later in the day. What surprised me most is how much better my digestion and focus have been since I added it into my diet. It's packed with over 50% plant-based proteins, essential vitamins, minerals, fibers, and antioxidants. Literally a whole nutrient boost in one scoop. And honestly, I feel it when I don't take it. Have you ever been looking for something simple that actually supports your energy, gut health, and even skin and hair? This is it. My listeners get 30% off their entire order with my promo code ZeroSignal. That's the biggest discount they offer anywhere. Just go to zavo.life and use code ZeroSignal at checkout. Again, that's zavo.life, code ZeroSignal. Try it for 30 days, risk-free, and see if you notice the difference, like I did.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Welcome back to Zero Signal, where we peel back the layers of history and legend to uncover what's real, what's rumor, and what still lives in the shadows. Today's story is one of the most famous military conspiracies of the 20th century, a tale of invisibility, teleportation, and sailors fused into the steel of their own ship. This is the legend of the Philadelphia Experiment. Dave, what do you make of this legend?
This is a really exciting story. The strange saga of the Philadelphia Experiment began in the summer of 1943 with the USS Eldridge, which was fresh out of the shipyard. So the legend goes, the Navy had outfitted her with these massive generators, coils as thick as electrical cabling, and exotic equipment said to be based on Einstein's field theory. The idea was simple in concept, but staggering in scope. Merging this electromagnetic field with gravity into a single force, it was said that the Navy could create this powerful field that bent light around the ship, rendering it invisible to both the naked eye and radar. The first runs of this test, at least according to the sailors' accounts, were very unsettling. When the equipment fired up, the ship would shimmer, wrapped in this haze of green light, and rose like mist, rose from the waterline that the ship was setting in. Men stationed on the deck complained of nausea, dizzy, pounding headaches. Some said they felt as if the air itself vibrated around them, thick with this like static and buzzing with invisible energy. These earlier tests convinced commanders that the project was on the edge of something really extraordinary. Then came the date etched into legend, October 28th, 1943. This was the day of the big test, the moment when the Navy would push the experiment button and push it to its limits. As the generators reached the full power, this huge hum built in this thunderous roar, witnesses described bolts of lightning arcing around the ship like St. Elmo's fire. And then before their eyes, the Eldridge vanished. Not just from Philadelphia, mind you. Not just from radar, but from existence itself. At that same moment, hundreds of miles away in North Fork, Virginia, dock workers and sailors swore they saw the Eldridge suddenly appear in their harbor, surrounded by this kind of eerie glow. Some claimed it lingered for several minutes before vanishing again, leaving only the churn of displaced water. Moments later, it reappeared back in Philadelphia, as if it had blinked across the map and snapped back into place. But what more importantly that it strikes with me, is it sounds like a horror film. You have this ship that has these huge devices on it. You have this eerie glow of fog that's surrounding it. Sounds very mythical. And I find it rather strange. And I would love to deep dive and to the man that's telling these stories, because something seems a little bit off to me.
Yeah, I just kind of want to paint a little bit of the backdrop for what was going on at that time. So it was the height of World War II, and the premise behind this experiment was in order to protect ships crossing the Atlantic. They were having a heck of a time with the U-boats sinking their ships as they crossed. So they wanted to find a way in order to either cloak their ships or hide their ships from, in particular, these sea mines, which were magnetic. So if you got close enough to one of them, the mine would eventually be magnetized and find its way to your ship. And the next thing you know, you're blown up and you're sinking. And there were magnetic torpedoes that the Germans used. So they were suffering catastrophic losses of their boats trying to cross over to Europe and to Great Britain. And that was the main reason that they were trying to find ways in order to protect their ships. It came with the purpose. And look at the story, and we'll come to our conclusions as we deep dive. But like you said, man, it's an interesting story. movie, and I find it fascinating. I think they made a movie of it back in 1984, and it's been in pop culture and conspiracy circles for decades and decades. So this is definitely an oldie but goodie.
Yeah, absolutely. And the context of that picture during World War II really, in my mind, sets the stage, because we see a lot of these strange inventions that occur, much like the heart attack gun, which we've talked about on other episodes. It kind of reminds me that World War II wasn't just fought with tanks and bombers. It was fought within the laboratories, chalkboards, and these locked doors. Across the U.S. and Europe, scientists really sworn to secrecy and told to chase ideals that sounded much like science fiction, because even if one of them worked, it might tilt the war in our favor. The public would later learn names like the Manhattan Project, where the desert sands of New Mexico glowed with test blast and physics turned into fire. But that wasn't the only really experiment hidden in plain sight during this time. Radar labs hummed through the night and really inventing the art of seeing what the eye couldn't see. We saw engineers tested decoys and deceptions, inflatable tanks designed to fool these recon planes, and radar ghost echoes. And they were trying to trick enemy operators. So you had the submarine killing sonar, the radar jamming, the false signatures. But then there was even these like stranger efforts I read about online. I heard that the British toyed with something called the Project Habaku. Not sure if you've heard of that one. It was a plan to build an aircraft carrier out of ice mixed with wood pulp, nicknamed, I think it was called Pyrite. And in Germany, scientists worked on De Glock, which is a bell, a device described in post-war accounts as a gravity Nazi or time bell. Machine, glowing and deadly, hidden in the mountain facility. Even the U.S. had flirtations with unusual technology, Project Pigeon, which I read about, where they trained birds, which were meant to guide missiles and acoustic weapons, and they focused around sound and disorient the enemy. Obviously, not all of these things work. Many were dead ends and abandoned when the war's pace outrun their promise. But the key is the atmosphere and the secrecy was everywhere during World War II, and these scientists were told to push the boundaries, to imagine the weapons, and think about the unthinkable. And these soldiers and dock workers and civilians lived alongside the curtain without ever being allowed to peek behind it. It's hard to imagine dockside rumors catching flame. A ship wired like Frankenstein's monster, humming with this like strange generators that bent more light. Officers who said nothing because silence was part of the uniform. A test that went too far and a result far too dangerous to really explain. That kind of sets the mood. There's so many extraordinary things that came out of World War II just to, like I said, tilt the war in the American favor.
Yeah, so let's just talk about some of the core claims. You may have touched on them a bit, but essentially it was a secret Navy experiment, often called Project Rainbow, and this occurred in 1943. In the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. The ship that was claimed to disappear was called the USS Eldridge, which you did touch on. And the intention was to make it invisible to radar and or visible light. So one of the interesting caveats of the story is that the ship teleported to Norfolk, Virginia through space and time. And when I say space and time, obviously it's going from the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard to Norfolk, Virginia. But witnesses claim, at least anecdotally, that the ship appeared 10 minutes before it actually disappeared in the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, which is mind-blowing. And it suggests that there was some time travel aspect to it. So crew members suffered severe side effects, nausea, madness, disorientation. Some were fused into the ship's metal hull and they had to be cut out or they just died on the spot, which sounds horrific. And like you said, it sounds like a horror slash sci-fi novel. Obviously, the Navy covered it up according to direct witnesses and they silenced people who knew too much. There's also an interesting claim from a guy named Bielek that claimed he was transported into the future and he ended up becoming a part of the Montauk Project, which essentially we can do a deep dive on that some other episode. But the Montauk Project pretty much deals with mind control, secret tunnels underneath Long Island. That conspiracy is super nuts. So the show Stranger Things is actually based off the Montauk Project. We can go into that in another episode. But again, this is conspiracies popping back into pop culture.
Yeah, it's a good point. The Montauk Project, as you stated, is based on Stranger Things. But there is a common thread there, teleportation. In both projects, they're speaking to teleporting from one place to another. I don't know if there's like a size variant versus people versus these massive ships, but maybe a good time to talk about what this ship is. At the center of the Philadelphia experiment sits a very real hull, the USS Eldridge. It's called DE-1-173 was its hull numbers. She was a cannon-class destroyer escort, one of really the workhorse ships that was built in American yards during the World War II. These ships were designed with one mission in mind, to guard the lifelines of war, the merchant convoys crossing crossing the Atlantic Ocean, prowled by the German U-boats. The Eldridge measured 360 feet from bow to stern. It displaced 1,240 tons and carried a crew of just over 200 sailors and officers. She could steam at 21 knots, armed with depth charges, torpedo tubes, 3-inch guns, and anti-aircraft barriers. Not glamorous, but absolutely vital. These ships were built quickly in number to plug the holes in the convoy that fed Britain, supplied North Africa, and prepared for D-Day. Eldridge was launched on July 25th, 1943, at the Federal Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company in Newark, and it was later commissioned in the U.S. Navy in August of 27. By December of that year, she was already in action, escorting a convoy to Casablanca. From there, she rotated through the lifelines of the war to Gibraltar, to the Azores, to the Bassatine, to Oran, and to Palomar. She protected merchant ships from wolf packs of U-boats, hunted submarines in the choke points of the Mediterranean, and carried out these escort runs as part of the mass buildup towards the invasion of southern France right around 1944. By the end of the war, Eldridge had completed 9 Atlantic crossings and countless escort duties in the Mediterranean. Her record was solid, but during those times, unremarkable. Exactly the kind of routine duty that kept the war machine running, but really never made headlines. After victory, Eldridge crossed not one ocean, but a stack of paperwork. In 1951, as part of the Mutual Defense Assistance Program, she was transferred to the Greek Navy. There, she took on a new name, HS Leon, with the hull number of D-54. For Greece, she remained a reliable escort and a patrol vehicle throughout the tense years of the Cold War. She served until 1990s, long after most of the American sisters had been scrapped, and finally was ultimately retired and dismantled at the end of the decade. And I think that's the hook. Nothing in her resume screams time machine. On paper, she dates tonnage, armaments, and ports of call, but in whispers, she is something else. The Eldridge is a perfect canvas for a legend. Ordinary steel, painted with extraordinary rumors. Stage role reality might have torn for a moment, then snap back as if nothing happened. And to me, steel kind of remembers, only dents and rust, but stories remember in stranger ways. And that like hum underfoot and that sticky kind of green fog rising from the water run, that feeling in there itself was about to crack. And I wonder, like a ship that's going to like transport from Philadelphia to Norfolk, and I don't know how many nautical miles that is, but it seems like a fairly great distance. When it does that, would it be damaged and like maybe perhaps beyond repair? The sailors are themselves are obviously dying from this experimentation. Would it also ruin the ship, like when it's being teleported?
Yeah, that's interesting. Where my brain goes with that is, it seems like it's affecting organic matter more so than it is affecting like elemental matter. So it's an interesting concept that it could teleport. I think Norfolk's only like 250 miles from the Philly shipyard. It's a far distance to teleport anything, but it's not like it's across the world. But it is interesting to see that organic humans were the ones that seem to have been the most affected. Obviously, it was still in service after this event for many years, and it doesn't seem like anything was damaged in the process. What kind of sticks out to me, and I'd like to know what you think, what you make of it, is the fact that the green fog always sticks out. What is that? It reminds me of something like nuclear. This was the time around the nuclear bombs. We know the government was working on a ton of secret projects. They did everything they could to hide the progress they made in nuclear weapons because they didn't want the Nazis or Russians to get it. But it lines up with this whole Einsteinian theory of relativity, how he was involved in the nuclear process, the whole Oppenheimer nuclear bomb making. So they're working on so much stuff. And whether or not I believe this conspiracy, I don't know. I think there's some truth in it somewhere. Did this event happen? I don't know. We can come to our conclusions as we break down the story a bit more. But this is around the time of the Roswell incident as well. So all these kind of strange events kind of line up around the same decade.
Yeah, almost every retelling describes the USS Eldridge as being swallowed by this green, kind of sickly, luminous mist that kind of then vanishes from sight. Some kind of curtain that hides it, and then it disappears. But I always still, like you said, I wonder where this detail come from and like, why does it stick? From my research, some say the fog was a byproduct of the ship's massive generators. In this version, the electromagnetic fields were so powerful, they ionized the surrounding air and seawater, creating this invisible glow, kind of plasm discharges and ozones and static, could all make the air shimmer this greenish white. Also, sailors might have described electrical halos, like in the St. Elmo's fire, phenomenon long seen by seamen during storms when the mast and riggings glowed in this kind of eerie light. And others take the fog more symbolically. The Philadelphia experiment isn't just about the ship, it's about the crossing the boundary. I think that fog becomes like this veil between the worlds, the curtain curtain pulled back where space and time are tampered with. And then I think in folklore, mist is often described in ghost stories and Celtic myths and even war legends where fog hides armies until that ultimate decisive moment. The green fog around the Eldridge turns the Navy Yard into the stage for the impossible. In more skeptical tellings, I think the fog might have started as nothing more than atmospheric distortion or heat haze on the river and ordinary dockside conditions that storytellers colored lit. Once one witness or writer adds that image of the green mist, others repeat it. It's this kind of verbal passed down, verbal lore that kind of gets added on. One of the things I always think about is when I was a cop and there's 19 witnesses and there's some tragic event that occurs. A major car accident, 19 people witness it. When I go to interview those 19 people, they all tell a different retelling of the story. But if you get them all together and they sit in a room for 10 minutes before I interview them, they all tell you the exact same story. And I wonder if that's something that happened here. Like, I saw a green mist. Oh yeah, I saw that too. I remember that now. Because when something tragic happens, say like they tried to have an experiment on this ship and a big fire broke out and a bunch of people died and it wasn't successful. The survivors are going to have that group think then, and they're going to start to recount the facts, and false memories are going to start to be implanted where they get on the same page. And to me, when they recount this with the green fog and all the other stuff of the fusing with the ship, it sounds like something tragic happened. I don't know if something mythical happened where they teleported from one place to another, but it sounds like something tragic happened. People got together to discuss what the heck did I just see, and they came out with this Star Trek kind of sci-fi vibe at the end.
So I think this is a good point to start to talk about where this story kind of came from. The thing that kind of bothers me with the story is that a lot of the renditions of it didn't start to come out until the 1950s, which, why was there almost a decade gap between the actual quote-unquote event to the actual retelling of the stories? You're in the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. You probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of sailors watching this happen. And you obviously have the 200-plus men on the ship that are manning it. Why are there not dozens, if not hundreds, of eyewitness accounts? So again, we'll go back into how the story began. So the first kind of character that pops up in this is a guy named Carlos Miguel Allende. He also goes by Carl Allende. So in 1955, 1956, Carlos sent letters to an author named Morris K. Jessup, claiming to be an eyewitness to the experiment and to have seen the Eldridge vanish. One of these letters included a technical sounding commentary and alleged firsthand details. And let's go back to Morris K. Jessup, the author. He published a book called The Case for the UFO in the 1950s. It's central to the story only because a bizarrely annotated copy of his book somehow ended up in the Office of Naval Research with an anonymous letter writer. And so this kind of drew the attention from the Office of Naval Research inquiring, like, why is there an annotated copy of your book in our files? So that kind of caused him to be questioned slash investigated a bit. And the name of the annotated copy is called the Varro edition. And it's got bizarre notes written in the margins, supposedly from two different Navy officers. And it circulated pretty heavily in the UFO community. So we can dig into that a bit, but a lot of these annotations reference this Project Rainbow. So again, pointing back to, I don't know how something would just automatically pop up in records of what I would think is a pretty freaking secure facility.
Yeah, it's a good point. And to go back on Carlos Allende, it's an alias. His real name is Carl Allen, and he just signed his letters that way to maybe to obscure his identity. And what I always found interesting is when he wrote these letters about this event, he signed them disrespectfully yours, Carlos Allende, who writes a letter like that? Like, he's spitting in your face when he writes that letter. And you touched up on Jessup, but the other character, I think, that also plays into this story, and I think you may have mentioned him earlier, but decades after this event occurred, Alfred Balog, better known as Al Balog, in 1989, he began speaking at conferences claiming he had recovered suppressed memories of serving aboard the Eldridge during the experiment. His tales went even further than Allen's. According to Balog, an Eldridge didn't just teleport from Philadelphia to New York. It ripped a hole in time itself. He claimed he and his brother jumped off the ship and fell forward through decades, ended up in Camp Hero in Montauk, Long Island in the 1980s. There, he said, they became entangled with another secret program, the Montauk Project, which allegedly experimented with time travel, mind control, and interdimensional gateways. In Balog's version of the events tied to the Philadelphia experiment, truly really this even larger web of Cold War paranoia and kind of science fiction conspiracy, ensuring the story would live on to modern age. But what we're seeing here, at least in my opinion, from a prior law enforcement perspective, is some characters you may not want to trust too much. And we'll dig into a little bit later why we should continue not to trust arrest them. But Carlo Allen specifically seems suspicious. And this guy that shows up a decade later saying he recovered suppressed memories seems pretty odd to me, too.
I kind of want to circle back real quick to the Varro edition and what was in the margins. So this is just a high level view. Oddly enough, in the Varro edition, some of the notes criticize Jessup, the author of one of his books, and it criticized his ideas on UFOs, and the people supposedly writing in the margins said that they had superior knowledge. So based off of what was in the margins, it looked like three different people, due to handwriting, were writing these margins, kind of handing this book back and forth, whether I doubt that they were right next to each other. I almost feel like, based off of how they try to sell the story, somebody would read it, write a note, hand it off, a couple days later, come back, hand it off, and so the circle continues. And this is when it gets a little bit fantastical, and I start to wonder if somebody's trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes. So the writers described L-Ms, so that essentially means large men, and S-Ms, essentially meaning small men, and these were apparently rival alien races with different agendas. It claimed to have ancient knowledge. The notes suggest ancient civilizations like Atlantis had advanced technology similar to UFO propulsion and the supposed unified field physics. They had it all figured out. And it linked it directly back to Project Rainbow and connected it with experiments in electromagnetism, invisibility, and teleportation, which are all things that are claimed in the Philadelphia experiment. It also described space travel physics, of all things. Wow, this guy's a super genius. They went into speculative details about how spacecraft operate using magneto hydrodynamics and field manipulation, and it also hints at human experiments. So in the margins, it applied that humans had tested dangerous field effects, aka the Philadelphia experiment, and suffered horrifying consequences. So that's really the high level view of what was written in the margins, which again, it's pointing back to aliens and somehow always pointing back to Atlantis. Atlantis always points back to this hidden secret ancient technology, and I just find it intriguing how all conspiracies point to the same direction, and this theory is no different.
Just to recap, are they saying that they gained the knowledge from the aliens in order to do the Philadelphia experiment? Is that basically what the book is pointing out?
Yeah, I think you can read between the lines that the large men and small men, whatever those are. I know people claim that Nordics are these tall race of aliens that look very similar to us, but they're blonde haired, blue eyes, pointing back to the whole Aryan thing. And I guess the small men, you could take the shot and claim that those are the grays, like the small, big headed, stereotypical aliens we see. But essentially that, yes, these aliens have somehow had this technology and working with our government to help us put it into action.
It's interesting. We see a lot of that. Like we talked about Antarctica, we've seen it spaced out. It's this desire to connect aliens to everything. Now, there could be some reality there. There could be some, dependent on, obviously not in World War II, but some nephophilium action that occurred in the background. But I feel like there's a strong desire to uncover aliens versus a lot of reality behind it as well. But when I think about this and alien technology, and can ships really disappear? Can people really disappear? Yeah, it makes me wonder if folks ever come close. So I did a little bit of research on that. Einstein himself worked on the unified field theory for the last 30 years of his life, but he never cracked it. After his death in 1955, other scientists picked up the torch. And while no one has really solved it, there have been a few moments in history when it felt like they were getting close. In the 1960s and 70s, physicists developed what's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. This was a huge breakthrough. It successfully unified three of the four fundamental forces: electromagnetic theory, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. These are forces that govern electricity, radiation, and the binding of atomic nuclei. The standard model has been tested thousands of times, and it works really well. But there's one big missing piece. It does not include gravity. Einstein's dream of folding gravity into the same framework really remains unresolved. Later in the 1980s, research proposed something called the Grand Unifying Theories, or the GUTs. These theories suggested that extremely high energies, like the conditions just after the supposed Big Bang, all three non-gravitational forces might actually merge into this single super force. The ideal holds promise, but again, gravity kind of refuses to play along. Then there's string theory, which became popular in the 90s and 2000s. String theory suggests that all particles and forces are actually tiny vibrating strings of energy existing in higher dimensions, more than four dimensions we know today. In principle, string theory can unify gravity with other forces, but I think here's the crutch. String theory is almost impossible to test experimentally. Without evidence, it remains elegant math rather than proven science. So I think to answer that question, question, right? Has anybody ever done it before? I think no one has ever really come close to building a working unified field theory that includes gravity. We made progress in the preceding years after World War II, but Einstein's dream never came true. And yet, the very gap between theory and proof is what gives stories like this their power. Because as long as science hasn't really closed the case, there's always room for imagination, always a chance, at least for legend to become reality, that someone else figured it out. And a lot of people, if they say they can't figure it out and they aren't believers in God, then they turn to an alternative source like aliens.
Yeah, I kind of to lay out some of the pop culture, some of the historical stuff with this. Looking at this story, the fact that the Philadelphia experiment became popular in the 50s. So let's rewind back to 1938. On October 30th, 1938, there was, you remember the War of the Worlds? So I'm just going to explain it to the audience. So there was a radio drama called The War of the Worlds that Orson Welles directed and narrated in live radio broadcast. If you were tuning into this, I don't know, a few minutes after it started, people actually believed that aliens were invading the world. People committed suicide. People started to panic. People literally lost their minds because they were convinced that they were hearing something on the radio. It must be real because the radio was the main form of media back then. Families gathered around, listened to it at night. And so that caused a big panic. And then everyone felt like a bunch of idiots once they found out it was just a radio drama. Then I want to fast forward to 1947. That's when the Roswell incident happened. That's in that decade period between 1938 and 1947, you have these two pretty significant cultural events that happened in America that really put everybody's radar up with aliens. That's when people started asking questions. That's when people, and this is where I think the Hucksters start to get into play, realizing that they can tell these fantastical stories and make some money off of it. So it's a little suspicious that the Philadelphia experiment kind of falls years before Roswell and roughly a decade after the world's broadcast. And I don't think it's any coincidence that these books and these stories started coming out in the 50s, a few years after the whole Roswell thing happened.
Yeah, it falls in line with that government cover-up troop that we usually hear about and why they say silence feels like the proof that they're trying to find. Because here's the thing about official denials. They're short. No record of that. No such program, period. Meanwhile, the myth really has this texture. It has people, places, bar fights, green fog. When one side offers a sentence and the other offers a movie, I think most minds want to buy a ticket. Wartime secrecy really wasn't optional. It was oxygen. And projects were compartmentalized. Paper trails were sparse by design. So when you ask for proof and you get a closed folder, I think your brain naturally is wired to complete the patterns, fill the gaps with the most compelling story at hand. Every no comment becomes a brick labeled as cover up. And once that wall is tall enough and any shaft of light that sneaks through, an odd memo, a reprinted book, a missing page, comments in line that shouldn't be there showing up at a government facility, really feels like this window into the forbidden. And that's not evidence, strictly speaking. I think it's mostly psychology. Because in my mind, psychology is where those legends live. And people want to explain something. People don't like to say, "But I don't know, I want to know." And if you can't prove it to me why it doesn't exist, then it must exist and you must be hiding it from me for some reason. And UFOs and Roswell that you were talking about, it's still a huge thing. People are still trying to ask Trump to release all the Roswell secrets. And it's been hidden behind this shroud of secrecy. I've seen people on YouTube videos that go out there and there's signs as if you cross this, we're going to shoot you. Now, it makes a lot of sense from a government facility standpoint. They don't know if there's a terrorist going to jump the fence and nuke the place or whatever. But to people, they don't think about that. They think, oh, I should be allowed to go there. And if you're keeping me out, it's not because it's protecting government stuff or facilities or people's lives. You're keeping me out because we have a giant, big green alien that we don't want you to see.
I want to circle back to the Project Rainbow. It's actually a declassified World War II program. So Project Rainbow did in fact exist, and it was essentially related to radar countermeasures and stealth against detection. The U.S. military used color code names extensively back in that time, like Project Rainbow, Project Bluebird, Project Paperclip. Rainbow seems to have been about reducing radar visibility, not literally invisibility. So the touch on what the project was is that they used something called degaussing coils, and they were installed on ships to counter magnetic mines. So essentially what this was is running heavy electric cables around the hull of the ship, sending a current through them. And from the outside, this could produce a glowing or shimmering corona discharge, exactly the kind of thing that to the layman would look something strange is happening. So essentially what these things did was they hid the ship's electromagnetic field so that these torpedoes or these sea mines wouldn't pick up on the fact that there's a 2,000 ton boat made of steel coming by. So it was, in fact, an actual experiment. And that's at least according to the government. And I know the government hides plenty of stuff and they redact plenty of documents, but that was the official narrative on what Project Rainbow was.
So invisibility in a different sense. It was shrouding the ship in secrecy, but not necessarily, at least what the U.S. government is admitting, doing this teleporting the ship to a different location. But it always makes me wonder when we start to see these government documents, we see the speculation. What if the Navy really had cracked it? What if those generators on the Eldridge had done exactly what the legend claimed? I think I picture convoys slipping across the Atlantic during World War II, cloaked from periscope eyes. I think I imagine these U-boats would stare through periscopes at empty seas, fire torpedoes at ghosts and watch their prey vanish into nothing. And supply ships would cross unchallenged, carrying food, fuel, troops to Britain without losing thousands of lives to these submarine wolf packs. But we didn't really see that. And what we see of the weapons during World War II that we did develop, or technology that we did develop, we implemented it because we needed every edge possible. And we needed to stop the war. We needed to save American, British, and others' lives. And we needed to put an end to it. And we needed the edge because there could have been an alternative history that was just a few things changed and we would all be speaking German now. So I wonder, because they did this big thing, but then it just went into the annals of history.
Yeah, I don't know. I think about technology back in World War II. Like, it was still, I don't want to say primitive because it wasn't. We were still using prop planes. We were using dumb bombs, bombs that just, you look through your little scope on your bomber and pick up the target and you push a button and the bombs just fall. So a lot of the times you might do a bombing run. That's why they needed 50 B-2 bombers to bomb an area, because they were just carpet bombing everything. Nothing was precise. For me, the biggest secrets in World War II were the nuclear experiments and them trying to code break the other person's transmissions. In terms of secrecy, I think it's about as advanced as we got. Late in the war, the Germans did develop jet fighters, which we were completely surprised by near the end of the war. It just was too late in the sequence of events for them to have any sort of positive outcome for the Nazis.
Teleportation would be the most amazing thing. I want to go to Italy.
Italy. Can we just transport these 10,000 troops behind Nazi lines real quick?
It would be great. Ultimately, the reason, based upon my research and what I found, why I don't have a lot of faith in this. So let's go back and talk about Carlos a little bit. Throughout his lifetime, post this event, many years later, he wavered between calling it a hoax and insisting it was true, which really left historians debating whether he was deliberately deceptive, perhaps mentally unstable, or both. His first confession came in the late 1960s, after the story began gaining this traction. Carlos wrote letters to researchers admitting that he had made the whole damn thing up. He explained that his letters to Morris Jessup were a prank meant to spook him. He specifically said he invented the annotations in the case of the UFO, and that there were no three different authors of the notes, only him. The confession came after Jessup's tragic suicide in 1959, which some had connections to the Philadelphia experiment publicity. Carlos seemed to show guilt during that time for that man's death, suggesting his hoax had unintended consequences. But not long after confessing, Carlos changed the story again, saying his confession was false and the experiment really happened. This flip-flop became a hallmark of his behavior, alternating between a hoax to claims of truth. Some accounts say he later insisted government agents pressured him into retracting the truth, which only adds fuel to the conspiracy lore. And then in the 1970s and 80s, in interviews and correspondence, Carlos repeated versions of both claims. Sometimes he said it was just a story. Other times he described in detail how sailors were fused into the metal of the ship, or how the Eldridge teleported from Philadelphia to Norfolk. His contradiction testimony, I think, undermines his reliability, but helped the myth grow. Before his death in 1994, Carlos was still writing letters and speaking about this with researchers. His tone shifted more towards the mythic version of events, time travel, invisibility, and the Tesla-based experiments. And ultimately, before he died, he never really settled on one final truth. Sometimes he wanted to expose himself as a trickster, and sometimes he wanted to be remembered as the man who revealed the government secret. And what that, if all those train of events are true, that I've looked up online, it speaks to a man that is kind of mentally perturbed. Like, he doesn't know what version of events that he wants to discuss. He doesn't know what he wants his claim to fame to be. I could see somebody confessing to something and then recanting it once because somebody forced him to, or he felt unsafe, or he felt at risk for his life because the government wanted to cover it up. But bouncing back and forth through this entire time, ultimately until he was fairly old when he passed away, makes me question this guy even further. And he's starting to call it all these pieces. I think eventually they did handwriting analysis on the, I think it was called the Vero book, and they found out that it was all tied back to him. Like, it matched his handwriting sample and all the information written in the sidebar. How he got there, how he delivered it, how he got into the facility, I don't know. I know Carlos obviously served in the military. He was a merchant marine. Perhaps he had access to these facilities during that time. But it just makes me question his reliability for this particular one.
Yeah, I'm not trying to defend the guy one way or the other, but it is, I don't think it's uncommon for somebody who spills a state secret to have the government come up to him and be like, yo, you need to stop this or you're not going to be around anymore. So I do think fear could be a good motivator to retract your story because you don't want to get murdered or have your family get murdered or whatever horrible crap that may happen to you. The mystery in all this that I want solved is, how did that book end up in the Office of Naval Intelligence? That's what I want to know. I'm sure it's probably not that big of a mystery. He probably somehow snuck in there or gave it to somebody who worked there and asked them to put it in one of the file rooms. But it was shocking enough for them to actually go out and try to investigate it. And I'm sure it's not fun being Jessup to have the Office of Naval Intelligence come to you like, why is your book in here and why are all these crazy notes in the margins? It also makes me wonder, because this project was declassified decades after the fact. And the project I'm talking about is Project Rainbow. And again, like we said, it was an actual top secret project. So a part of me thinks that somehow Carlos knew something about this project. Somehow he got some sort of information. He created this fantastical story, somehow got that book in there. And then the Navy's thinking, why is there a book written by some random dude that has notes in the margins about Project Rainbow? He shouldn't know about this. Let's go figure out who spilled the beans and get down to the bottom of this. That right there is, I think, the biggest conspiracy of this whole show.
It's a good point. We always heard the phrase, loose lips sink ships. I think as you build these massive coils and you pit them on the ships, people got to be talking about it. Like, it's hard to hide. I don't know where they were actually out retrofitting this ship with the coils and all the things that they were doing for Project Rainbow. I suspect in Philadelphia, Naval Yard somewhere. But I almost suspect, like, how can you conceal that? And though folks are obligated to their security clearances, we see people all the time break those. And they tell their friends, it's okay if I tell my mom and dad and brother, but I won't tell anybody else. And then brother finds out about it. It's okay if I tell this person, they won't find out about it. And it just starts to spread. And he served. I don't know as much about Jessup's background, but Carlos served as a merchant marine. So he had ties within those inner circles. He served during World War II. He probably saw some combat and he served during that time. So it wouldn't be out of the realm possibility that he would learn about it along the way, at least in my mind.
Yeah, the other thing that kind of bothers me about this story is that ships have detailed logs of where their locations are. And it doesn't mean that these logs can't be fabricated, altered, or just even erased altogether. But according to the ship's logs, in 1943, it was in the Mediterranean. So it can't be, I guess it could be two places at once, according to this story, because it can transport all over the world. But barring the teleportation part of this, it was thousands and thousands of miles away from the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard.
Yeah, it's detailed, and it won't back into service after we sold it off. We know the long history of the ship, and I don't know, man. Of the conspiracy theories we talk about, I always think there's breadcrumbs of truth. I have a hard time particularly buying this one. What I didn't find, and perhaps you did, is so we have the characters in play in Philadelphia when this experiment occurs. We at least have one witness that speaks about it. They say people see it in Norfolk. Like, they see it appear in Norfolk briefly before, I guess, it disappears again. But nobody really witnesses have come forward and said, I saw a giant ghost ship that kind of passed through this harbor. Nobody's on record. It just, some people said it, which I find interesting, is that you supposedly had a witness account, but nobody's actually a witness.
Yeah, this is where stuff starts to fall apart for me with conspiracies. Just like with Project Bluebeam, when somebody claims to get some sort of hard, tangible evidence, they never, for some reason, produce it. And then the other evidence is, I heard a guy tell me XYZ. XYZ is really not that reliable of a piece of evidence to me. Is this person mentally ill? Is this person looking for attention? Is this person just full-blown, in the full-blown psychosis? It gets a little bit weird. And there were also are some one-off stories about witnesses seeing some of these sailors that were apparently on the Philadelphia experiment on the Elk Ridge. According to the story, when the ship came back, teleported back, became visible again, not only were people fused in the ship, but some people were just missing. They weren't there at all. And there are some firsthand or secondhand accounts of people seeing somebody who should have been on this ship in a bar, and when they go up to them, they disappear. So they vanish right in front of their eyes. Again, this sounds like stuff out of a horror slash sci-fi
sci-fi movie to me.
Before we wrap the show up, I do want to talk about a fellow named Al Bielek. Because if you think Carlos had a wild, this guy's tale gets crazy out of control. He was born Edward Cameron, and according to his claims, he goes by the name of Al Bielek. So in the late 1980s, 1990s, he came forward at a UFO and conspiracy conference saying he recovered suppressed memories of being directly involved in the Philadelphia experiment. He tied himself to the legend of the USS Eldridge, and he tied this in with time travel, mind control, and even the Montauk Project, like we stated before. His court claims were that he was there. Bielek claimed that he served aboard the USS Eldridge during the Philadelphia experiment in 1943, and he did so under the name of Ed Cameron. He said that his brother, Duncan Cameron, were Navy sailors assigned to operate the ship's massive electromagnetic equipment. So he claims when the experiment began, the ship was engulfed in the greenish haze, like we talked about, and vanished. Bielek and Duncan jumped overboard, but instead of hitting the water, they fell through a tunnel of light and ended up in the year 2137. So already this story is getting wild. So he claimed he spent weeks in 2137 recovering in a futuristic hospital bed where doctors use advanced light-based healing. He said he saw visions of post-apocalyptic America with huge earth changes, reduced population, and a very authoritarian world. So he did another leap to the year 2749. So after he spent weeks in 2137, he said he was transported even further to 2749. He said there humanity lived in floating cities run by artificial intelligence. Money no longer existed, and society was governed by a synthetic intelligence. Which, if I was to believe anything, I think this is where society's going. But anyway, he claimed to have spent 2 years there before being sent back. When he got returned to the quote-unquote past, he and Duncan eventually were poured back in the 1943 onto the deck of the Eldridge. The experiment was obviously considered a disaster. Many crew were dead, insane, or just fused to the ship. Bielek later tied the story to the Montauk Project, claiming the government continued invisibility and time travel research into the 70s and 80s. And he said he worked at the Montauk under his second quote-unquote life identity as Al Bielek, and that his memories were suppressed through control up until the 80s when he saw the movie The Philadelphia Experiment, which was made and released in 1984, and he had this complete remembrance. His amnesia was gone, and he remembered all this experience. He did give some quote-unquote evidence. He claimed that his body showed signs of aging inconsistencies, which supported his claim of time travel. I don't know, man. Like, how do you show signs of aging inconsistencies? Some people age fast, some people age slow. I don't even know what that means. And he did speak in technical terms like zero point energy, electromagnetic fields, the unified field theory, mixing real science with jargon and pseudoscience. So he also made some prophecies. He made predictions about earth changes between 2000 and 2025, including shifting coastline and mass depopulation. According to my watch, I think we have 3 months until all these prophecies have to happen. I don't know, man. There's no digging in deeper. There's no record, no Navy records of Edward Cameron serving on the Eldridge. His timeline shifted over the years, and his details, again, contradicted documented history. These recovered memories were probably just inspired by science fiction, movie books, and the conspiracy lore that spread in the 80s. And he borrowed heavily from Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, who wrote the Montauk Project series. I don't know, man. I don't even know what to say about this right now, but you go from Carlos, who's writing notes in the book and sending letters to this guy, said he lived 700 years in the future.
You know what movie I watched yesterday? Indiana Jones. I realized that I'm Dr. Jones. This is insanity.
2742.
Yeah.
I met Al Bielek out in 2749. I know the story's real.
Yeah. A very popular movie comes out and all of a sudden he realizes he has suppressed memories. That just sounds, let's call it insanity to me. You want to live something, so you impersonate it. That's crazy bizarre. His entire, we touched on it a little bit earlier in the episode. I was talking about his past and you talked about the present that he experienced, but I'm not buying it.
I know. I don't either. So I want to wrap up the show with what you think actually happened and what you think this actually is.
It's a good question. I think at the end of all this, ships vanishing in the fog, sailors caught between worlds, and stories that really refuse to die, I think we're left with a question about what's real and what's legend. As Christians, we know the human knowledge has limits. For every equation written on a chalkboard, for every experiment whispered, there's a truth greater than anything we can ultimately invent. For me, scripture reminds us of Colossians 1:17. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. To me, the Philadelphia experiment asks, what if a man could bend the fabric of reality? To me, faith answers. Only God holds reality itself in his hands. We may chase mysteries, we may imagine what could have been, but we trust that the creator is the one who speaks space, time, and light into being. So when I look at stories like this, as a former detective, what do these people have to gain? It seems like they have a lot to gain. They gain fame, perhaps fortune, through this entire process. And I don't trust it. He eventually comes out and says that he lied and he recants. And this story is just hidden with a lot of fantastical elements that ultimately can't be proven. Now, I'm not one that says I trust the government and everything they say. They know a whole lot more than they're willing to tell us. That's 100% for certain. Some is for protectionism, right? They don't want the enemy to get their hands on the technology that we have. I think what's most probable is that in Philadelphia during 1945, when Project Rainbow was occurring, they were trying to, as you spoke about, escape the magnetic mines and trying to escape the wolf packs. And they were trying out some new tools in their arsenal. There were large coils on the ships. They were doing all these other things to try to circumnavigate it. And perhaps what happened is a tragedy, a fire started. People died. And when that happened, the government covered it up as much as they like to do, because they don't want to talk about the technology that they were trying to deploy to circumnavigate around what the Nazis were doing. So that makes a lot of sense to me. We do have a government conspiracy there, but I think the government conspiracy is not about a teleporting ship. It's about Project Rainbow and perhaps a tragedy that occurred where sailors lost their life. But for this one, check me out, man. I'm not buying what Carlos and his friends are selling.
Yeah, man, I could buy that one. Me personally, I just don't see, again, I don't see evidence. So you have Carlos who's writing letters and he's always recanting and then restating. And then you have Al Bielek who comes up with the most fantastical story of debatably the 20th century. Time travel, again, we go back to climate change and mass depopulation and catastrophes. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem believable to me. And the fact that the Eldridge wasn't even there, it doesn't mean that there wasn't another ship there and something happened. But in my mind, if you're doing a secret experiment to make a ship invisible, why would you do it in the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard? Why wouldn't you do it off the coast of Nova Scotia where nobody's at? That way nobody can see it. That way there's no witnesses, and the only people that are a part of it are the sailors on the ship. And if it goes invisible, most of those guys are inside the hull. They're not going to know what happened. So you have an observer ship, and then you have the ship you're doing the experiment on, and only the people on the deck. The only people on the deck are people that are actually involved in this experiment. We know how compartmentalized the government is. They don't show off in front of thousands of people. Heck, a lot of the soldiers that are being experimented on don't even know what's going on. So none of it really lines up with how the policies and process that the government uses to keep stuff secret. None of it lines up. And the other thing that kills me too is that if you had thousands of people that witnessed this, you would think you'd have thousands of stories, if not tens of thousands of stories, secondhand, third hand. My dad saw this, my uncle saw that, my grandpa said this. And why wouldn't you have hundreds of stories of the people on the ship saying, you won't believe what happened? Like, this dude was fused into the hull and he's screaming in agony, and this other guy went crazy, and this other guy just wasn't there. It's just too many people not to have, again, thousands of stories. And it, even if they were scared, why were there not deathbed confessions trying to get this stuff off their chest, trying to expose it? So none of it, dude, I want to believe it because it sounds so cool and it sounds just super sci-fi, which I love that. I love the sci-fi genre, but I just don't think there's enough evidence to support anything happened at all. And again, the government can cover up and alter records of where ships were. And unless I see the evidence, I'm not going to believe it, man. And there's just not enough. There's maybe less than five stories about this from three or four different people. And it's all, they claim to be two firsthand witnesses. It just doesn't pass the smell test for me, brother.
I agree. And you made a really good point. When we think about the Manhattan Project, where did that occur? It wasn't occurring. I get they were blowing big things up, but it occurred out in the middle of nowhere, not in some harbor that's very populated. Obviously, Philadelphia is a very populated area where you're going to have hundreds and thousands of witnesses that could potentially see something and expose the government project that's ongoing. Very good point. What do you want to leave the audience with tonight?
Don't believe everything you hear or see. Jesus loves you. We love you. Pray for discernment and wisdom, because you can't believe every story a huckster or false prophet tells you, man. You got to ask God for that wisdom and discernment. He'll let you know. He'll tell you. He'll guide you.
Yeah, 100%. As we always say, discernment. I think reality is always somewhere in the middle. It's not saying I don't believe in any conspiracy theories, because there are things that I believe in, but there's some that, like you said, don't pass the smell test. As a law enforcement officer, I would never believe them. If you want to tell me to go charge somebody because of this, that wouldn't happen. There's not enough evidence. What it also really comes down to is cops are, is just logical. Is it logical? No, it's not. Like you said, have discernment, believe in Christ, question everything. And until next time, we're Zero Signal.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.
This episode is brought to you by Prep Starts Now, because life doesn't come with a warning. When an emergency strikes, whether it's a power outage, natural disaster, or even a medical scare, the last thing you want is panic. Prep Start Now empowers families to be ready with the right tools, knowledge, and confidence. They're about smart planning so you can focus on protecting your family instead of scrambling for solutions. Their shop has everything from first aid kits and water filtration to backup power and essential gear. Plus, their Prep Academy makes it easy to learn emergency skills with simple guides and quick tips anyone can follow. I've arranged an exclusive 15% discount for my listeners. Just go to PrepStartsNow.com and use promo code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, or click the link in my show notes where the discount is applied automatically. Don't wait for the next crisis. Take action today. That's PrepStartsNow.com. Promo code ZEROSIGNAL.